This is Art/Geek, a podcast about the interesting things that happen at the intersection of art and technology with Russ Olson
and Chris Bailey.
This is episode 28 for Sunday, December 20th, 2009. This week it's all about how complicated the world is, and we'll also hear about a guilty pleasure that Chris would rather not talk about.
Today, Chris, I thought we could talk about something that is ever-present in all of our lives, and somehow the more we do and the harder we work, the more of it we have. I want to talk about chaos.
Oh, I thought you were going to say lint.
Lint. Dust?
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe lint and dust are a little chaotic,
well,
aren't they?
Yeah. Chaos, especially this week. I've had my share.
So what is... I mean... Chaos has a very specific meaning in science and math, and it means something a little different, although related to the ordinary meaning of chaos. But there's chaos in our lives, and there's sort of randomness, which is a little chaotic mm-hmm. in art and music and things like that. So what do you think chaos is?
I was going to say the look of randomness or the appearance of a lack of order to things. Or the way I use it, maybe haphazard amalgamation of things, like things coming together in a certain way.
So not completely random, but not really in any kind of order either. We were talking a little bit earlier about chaos and art. And of course, when you think of sort of randomness or chaotic things in art, one name comes to mind, and that name is...
One name would work, Jackson or Pollock.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, Jackson Pollock is what most people think of, and rightfully so. It wasn't just the style makes people think it's formless or maybe improvised. And we're finding out that even what appears to be improvised, there's always something more to it than that.
So it's somehow there's, at least in his work, there's some kind of order hidden behind all of that randomness. Mm-hmm. That's what the feeling you have. You look at those paintings and you think, well, first I always think, my, he had a lot of paint.
He must have had space.
Yeah.
And he must have just ruined his clothes.
Yeah, and boy, was his wife yelling at him. That's the other thing I think.
No wonder he drank.
Yeah. But if you look at those paintings, you look at them and... At first, they seem completely chaotic, but if you look at them for a while, there's some semblance of something behind there. Mm-hmm. I always look at them and think that it's almost like a blurry picture of something, and I can't quite make out what it mm-hmm. is. I mean, maybe it's all in my head or something like that, but there does seem to be some order back there, and that's what I find intriguing about those pictures and that.
Well, and, you know, that sets – or there's a certain precedent for that if you think about the Impressionist.
Yeah, where there's more order in the Impressionist.
Where there's order, but historically people would – after a certain point, and before that, things were a lot more stylistic than representational. And then let's just pick around the time of the Renaissance, where people started to become more accurate in their depictions of things, better draftsmanship, better
perspective,
sense of perspective. We began to expect that, for lack of photography, we wanted our paintings to display things in a certain way, and that's we developed a taste for them, and that's what we wanted them to look like. Unless, of course, we were dealing with the questions of, you know, spirituality, and then of course you could have a golden halo
behind
your head or something. But other than that, you know, you wanted it to look realistic.
Well, it's the halo is sort of the symbolism behind the or around the realism,
Yes, and they tried to do it in what they imagined to be a realistic way, even though that was pretty hokey most of it. So you get these people, the Impressionists, at the end of the 19th century, and they are showing, the name comes from the idea that they're giving you an impression of a subject.
Not a realistic, not a realistic, almost photo quality picture of what's going on, but more like what's going on, plus their feelings about what's going on.
Sure. But even like a more sketchy painting. And I think it's the sketchiness. Like, if you saw it in drawing, I think it would be acceptable. But to see it in a painting, you're like, wow, you know, is that really worth all the time and effort? Or, you know, whatever. There were a lot of objections people had at the time. Where today, I would say that Impressionist paintings were the model for what we, you know, over 100 years later, what we use to design icons for software or for websites. Yeah, because you are taking an idea and you're even though it's like the interesting thing is that it becomes much more based on the rectangle and precise. It's you're creating the impression of something using really things that don't represent what it is you're trying to say at all.
So you're saying we should call that thing at the bottom of just about everybody's computer desktop impression trash can.
Yeah, exactly.
That's, you know, I never thought about it in those terms. Well,
I think it's from you know, when you build enough, you think, you know, there is a level of a remove that happens when you're trying to put some of these things together. And I'm not just talking about, I mean, the ubiquitous globe and magnifying glass, which can be, you know, done fairly simply and be easily recognizable. But there are some icons that get built that are based on very abstract or conceptual ideas that even if you've got the call out underneath saying what it does, you still might not know what it does because it's so specific within a certain kind of application.
And of course, icons and the fact that you need about 8 million of them to really set, you know, I'm looking at your Mac desktop and I can see probably 25 different icons trying to represent lots of different ideas. And the whole reason we need so many of these icons is because the world is so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's so... And in some ways, you know, if you asked, I bet if you, you know, went back even hundreds of years and could ask in some way that somebody would understand you, how do you feel about life? I think chaos, the word chaos would, in whatever language, would come up because our everyday experience of life is that at least part of the time it's chaotic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we look at the world, you look at the sky, and the clouds sort of seem semi-random, a little chaotic. They're certainly not nice squares or rectangles with sharp edges, you know, that kind of thing.
Weather is chaotic.
You look at
nature.
You look at mountains and stuff like that. And that was a real problem going back about 400 years, 500 years. That was a huge problem. And the reason it was a huge problem is that Isaac Newton, who was born in 1643 and did his work like in the 1680s, I guess, the stuff I'm talking about.
And he's from Quebec.
He's Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton basically founded modern physics. And he set down these three laws and the law of universal gravitation, you know, the thing everybody imagines he's getting hit in the head with the apple and he realizes there's gravity. He set down basically these four fundamental ideas about how the world works that lasted, well, they last till today. If you talk to an engineer who's going to design a car or something, he's still using Newton's laws. If you talk to a nuclear physicist, he's using Einstein's slight tweak of Newton's laws. But Newton sat down and he said, he looked around at the world and he said, here's how the world works. If I put some object down and it's not moving, it wants to stay not moving. Right? Very simple idea. And I'm going to connect this with all the chaos stuff, so to bear with me for a second. If I get something moving, and this was a real insight, if I start something moving, it will keep moving pretty much at the same speed until I do something to it. And that's sort of not our everyday experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I roll a ball, eventually the ball is going to stop. But Newton saw that it was sort of the friction of the ground, that the ball wanted to roll forever. And if you sort of imagine, recently there was an astronaut who lost a very expensive toolkit in orbit. The thing just sort of drifted away. Maybe she knocked it or something like that. And it started drifting. And an hour later, it was miles away from the space station. And a day later, it was maybe 1,000 miles away from it. It just keeps going because there's really nothing to bother it out in space. And so Newton saw that if you start something going, it just wants to keep going at the same speed. Very, very simple. His second thing was that if you do sort of push on something, the harder you push on it, the faster it goes. That's, you know, very, and the heavier it is, the slower it goes. That's kind of common sense, too. Again, very simple kind of ideas. And then the third one, which is the famous, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, which basically means that if you push on something, it pushes back on you. And that's all that means. So if I jump, you know, if I like jump down onto the floor is sort of pushing me up. That's why I don't go through it. But I'm also pushing on the floor, right? So three very simple ideas. And then the law of universal gravitation, which is that everything in the universe kind of attracts everything else. So as much as I hate to admit it, there's a certain attraction between you and I, Chris. It's very, very slight. But, you know, even between two things as small as people, there's a very slight gravitational attraction. It's nothing compared to the gravitational attraction that's sticking me to the ground, because the Earth is so much bigger than any person or anything like that. That's why the Earth can sort of stick you to its surface, where you and I can sort of pretend that there is no attraction, which is what we're going to do from here on.
Well, I was originally thinking that those first three laws also sounded like the laws of teenagers, where they're not moving, they don't want to move.
Right, you know. Right. And once you get them going, it's hard to stop them.
It's hard to stop them until they see a couch. Yeah.
Right. So, but the thing is that during Newton's lifetime and thereafter, people realized that these really were more or less the fundamental laws that govern everything. So you drop a rock on the ground and it's obeying all these laws. The moon going around the Earth is obeying exactly the same laws. Things from very small to very large obey all these laws. And they're all very, very simple, straightforward laws, you know, just a few equations, not kind of thing you learn in high school physics. So why is the world so complicated? How could we start with these very simple things and get mountains and clouds and the moon with all these pockmarks on it and all the rest of the very complicated things? Shouldn't everything be sort of straightforward and simple and boring? Shouldn't the clouds be perfect spheres and shouldn't the mountains sort of be perfect triangles? It's the sort of thing that you get from very, very simple equations. Why is the world so complicated? Because we know it's complicated in our real life. And that was the kind of thing that people, on the one hand, sort of thought about a little bit. It was the art/geek of maybe the 1700s, because on the one hand, you have the physicists saying there's these very simple laws and everything moves in a straight line and you know, interacts with gravity and equal and opposite reactions. And then you had maybe artistic people saying, well, yeah, but, you know, that's not how the world really seems to work. Mm-hmm. You know, that everything's very chaotic and you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Where you would think with these very simple laws, we could predict perfectly what's going to happen tomorrow.
Well, I think that either group could look at the moon and say, and see that it was round.
Yes.
But what we found out is that on closer examination, it is round. But when you get up close enough to it, you realize it's only round from a great distance.
Right. It's a little bit closer, and it's very, very complicated with jaggy mountains and, and holes that are not exactly 1 foot and 2 foot and 3 foot or whatever. They're holes of all different sizes. And, you know, it's just another aspect of the fact that the world is so complicated. Yeah. And how could the world be so complicated if, at its very fundamental level, it had these very simple equations? Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a disconnect there, that there's something we're missing, that the world is so complicated, but at its very core, it's, you know, it's got these very simple equations.
Well, and those simple equations, I think, open up the world to greater analysis. Like, if you establish that as a baseline,
right,
you can say, okay, if that's true, let's take another look at this, and we find out that there's either a greater level of complexity, or we can extrapolate greater meaning out of it.
I think one of the things that people thought is that for a long time was that surely there must be something else going on, that these simple equations, there's no way that they're generating all of this complexity. There's got to be something else. And I think probably that's what people thought for a long time and what that something else was. But then turns out that sometime after Newton's lifetime, probably in the 1700s, they started worrying a lot about the motion of the moon for a very good reason. It was they were having trouble navigating ships across great distances. And it's hard to tell where you are east-west if you're on an ocean. It's pretty easy to tell. You can look at the stars and tell where you are north-south. Mm-hmm. East-west is a completely different story. It's hard to tell. People worked out that if they could predict exactly where the moon would appear in the sky, and it would look a little different if you were on a ship off Japan or something like that, if you knew where the moon was supposed to be, say, looking at it from England, and you could look at it from Japan, you could know that I'm, you know, 50 miles from the coast of Japan. So they started thinking really hard about how exactly does the moon move around the Earth,
okay,
right? Just practical kinds of things. And it turns out that the main things that are important for how the moon moves around the Earth are the moon, the Earth, and the sun, because the sun's big enough and it pulls on the moon and it kind of disturbs the whole sort of perfectly more or less circular orbit. And so you have these three things, the Earth, the moon, and the sun, and they're all kind of going through their motions. And it's the kind of problem that's perfectly designed for Newton and his equations. Mm-hmm. And they sat down, and I sort of have this feeling that the first person who sat down said, well, I'm going to spend the afternoon and figure this out. I've got these three things, and I've got all these equations, and how hard can this be? And it turns out it's incredibly hard. It's almost impossible. If you have two things and you have Newton's equations, you can work out the motion of two things, the Earth and the sun. If you ignore everything else but the Earth and the sun, you can figure out where the Earth is going to be. If you know where it is now, you can figure out where it's going to be basically forever, if you know it's where it is and how fast it's going. You throw the moon in there, and suddenly it's a whole different story. You just cannot make the math work, except in very special cases. It turns out it's very, very complicated to figure out. And it's so complicated that this problem has its own name. It's called the three-body problem, you know, where you got the Earth and the moon and the sun.
That's not just who rides in the middle and the back seat.
No, okay. No. Or some problem with, you know, organized crime figures.
Now, what is that? Does that have something to do with the fact that the moon has its own gravitational field?
Yeah, it has to do with the fact. Look at it this way. You're trying to figure out where the moon is going to be. So you know where the moon is, you know where the Earth is, you know where the sun is. But everything's moving a little bit. The Earth is actually moving around the sun. It's dragging the moon with it. The moon is moving around the Earth. But the moon, the sun is also pulling on the moon a little bit, right? So it's kind of disturbing things. So the reason it's so complicated is, think of it this. If I know right at this second where the moon is and where the Earth is and where the sun is and how fast all three of them are going, and I say, okay, well, now I'm going to kind of roll the movie forward, I don't know, an hour. So I need to be able to figure out all of the poles on the moon so I know where it's going to go, you know, at the end of the hour. Well, gee, I need to figure out, well, the moon is this far from the Earth, so I can figure out the gravity between the two of them. The moon's this far from the sun, I can figure out the gravity between them. And now I go to push it forward, you know, roll the tape forward an hour so I can figure out where everything is in the next hour. And I realize that now the moon isn't quite exactly that distance from the Earth. anymore. It's changed a little bit, and it's a little bit different distance from the sun. And on top of it, the sun and the earth are pulling on each other, and they're moving. So it's hard to, it's one of these things where every time you pin one thing down, something else changes on you.
Mm-hmm.
And just the, those simple equations that we sort of looked at and we thought, ah, we, you know, I'll work this out in an afternoon. It turns out that there's a lot of complexity in those simple equations. And the complexity comes from the fact that those simple equations, they're working over and over and over. Every second, the moon changes position, and it's a different distance, just slightly, from the Earth and the sun. And every second, the Earth moves, and it's a different distance from the sun and the moon. And every second, the sun's actually moving a little bit. And it's a different, and all you roll all that together, and it's hard to even, like, get a grip on the problem enough that once you figured one thing out, it's wrong now because everything else has changed. And it's not like something involved in like measuring things in a practical kind of way. It's all coming out of those little equations that everybody thought was very simple. Turns out that they're maybe not that simple.
Well, and to put that in a different way, I mean, we're still using essentially the same calendar that Julius Caesar developed, the Roman calendar.
Right, okay.
Okay, so back then and even before then, we get the sense that ancient civilizations had a pretty good idea where the moon was going to be a year from now.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. But it's when you start thinking about why, or let's be more precise about where it's going
to
be.
And that's exactly where these guys were going. They didn't want to, it's easy enough to figure out that in a year the moon will be, you know, half full or crescent, and it'll be more or less in this part of the sky, or even fairly accurately. But if I want to know exactly where it's going to be, because the difference between looking at the moon from Japan and looking at it from England is not that much. And so I have to know exactly where it's going to be so I can tell the difference and figure out where I am. Turns out they never really did manage to make that work very well, and they found a different way to figure out where they were.
Compass?
No, actually clock, an accurate clock. If you can, it's the time difference. You know, they would figure out if they could have a clock that was set to the time in London, say, and then you take it on your boat and you go a few hundred miles away from London and you look up at the sky and you say, ah, right now it's noon wherever I am. And I look at my clock and I say, ah, but it's 10 minutes of noon in London. That means I must be this far away because of the time difference. And that's how they eventually worked it out. Some guy spent the better part of his life building more and more accurate clocks, which is that, you know, the sailors call them chronometers. And that's why they're so important, or at least they were before the days of GPS.
Yeah.
And that's why you always sort of see sailors in these old movies with the little, they're called sextants. They look at the sun. They're trying to figure out when is it noon right where I am, and then I'll compare it to where when it's noon in London, and we still do that. That's Greenwich Mean Time, actually, in Greenwich. And then we can figure out where we are, east-west. Anyway, in the 1880s, there was a Frenchman, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher his name, Henri Poincaré. An American would read that as Poincaré, but Poincaré maybe is how he pronounced his name. Our French listeners will forgive me. Anyway, he was studying the three-body problem. At that point, the three-body problem was more like an academic exercise. Mm-hmm. Like, surely we should be able to figure this out. We're really smart people.
Right.
And he found that there were certain, if you started the three, say the sun, the moon, and the earth, in certain ways, you know, sort of stop thinking about it in terms of the sun, the moon, and the earth, and just think of it as like three heavy things attracting each other, kind of floating around in space. He found that there were certain starting positions where you could send these things off. You would sort of expect that if you started three things off moving and attracting each other, one of three things would happen. They'd either be going so fast that they just all go their separate ways, right? There's not enough gravity to hold them together, and off they'd go. Or that they'd all be sort of going slow enough that they'd slowly collapse and all be stuck to each other at some point. Or it would be more like the Earth and the Moon, where one would just circle the other endlessly, or something like that, something that repeats. And that was sort of what people went into it thinking. And what he found was there were certain ways you could start these things off, start kick the three bodies off in different directions at different speeds, where they wouldn't split apart, they wouldn't fall together, but it also wouldn't repeat. They would just endlessly sort of weave in and out of each other, never repeating exactly the same patterns. And it's all just coming from these three or four or five simple little equations.
Now, was that something he would have tried to duplicate with observable objects?
No, he was like working it out mathematically.
Okay.
And he worked out that there were certain initial conditions, is what they call it, sort of certain starting, you know, if I start where this thing's going this fast and this thing's going in this direction and this, you know, the second one's going this fast in this direction and the third one's going in this direction, that they wouldn't scatter apart, they wouldn't fall together, but they also would not repeat. They would just mm-hmm. endlessly kind of weave in interesting patterns. And that was the first indication we had of what technical people, mathematicians and physicists, call chaos. That's their idea of chaos. It's a system that starts out with, you know, is usually based on very simple mathematics, but doesn't do simple things, that doesn't repeat, and it doesn't sort of turn into something very simple like all of the objects just flying apart. It does very complicated things, and it's just what's wrong. You remember we started by asking or saying that people thought for a while that there was some extra thing in the world that was making the world complicated, that mm-hmm. we had these very simple equations, but there must be something else. It's our intuition that was wrong. Those very simple equations can generate mm-hmm. massive complexity.
One thing that tells me, or confirms something that I already believe, that so many times on the face of any situation that seems overwhelming or complicated, often there are, to step back from it a bit, you find out that there are predictable patterns. I mean, chaos is also the sense of things not being predictable.
Yes.
And from what, you know, the numbers say, even if you take it out really far, you still might not know unless you are sure you have everything right.
Yes.
But in our experience where the world is very complicated, if you were somehow able to step back a bit and maybe compare notes with other people, whatever the situation is, you'd find out, oh, okay, this isn't as complicated as I think. I'm not the only person in the world dealing with this.
Yes.
So in a related way, by things becoming much more complicated, we are able to understand that even at its most complex, what it means to be alive is still rooted to many of the same things that it's always been.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. For me personally, what this says is, you know, people will say this sometimes, you're having trouble doing something. And someone, you hear this a lot in software engineering, someone will come along and maybe look over your shoulder, either literally or sort of metaphorically, and say, well, look, you're only dealing with A, B, and C. How hard can this be? the answer from all this stuff is really, really hard.
Yeah. Maybe that's not such an easy question.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've beaten chaos. Not at all today.
That was, I was going to say that
chaos maybe has beaten us.
That wasn't so hard.
Yeah.
Today's guilty pleasure, and I say guilty knowing it sounds disparaging, but it is guilty. It's something I feel guilty about, is a comic book. And the reason I feel guilty...
You mean other than the fact that it's a comic book?
No, it's because it's a comic book. I mean, the thing is, I would love to make my living drawing comic books, but the comic books that we grew up with are not something you generally see grown people in America reading. Now, that could change.
Batman and Superman and that kind of stuff.
And that will change. And if you go to other countries, primarily right now France and Japan, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, they have a very rich cartooning culture. And you see people all over the place reading comics. And they have as much respect for cartoonists as they would for, I think, for artists and maybe comedians at least, you know. But the book that I brought in, it's a book called Black Hole by Charles Burns. And this is a collection of what had been maybe 20 to 30 issues done in comic book form, or even more graphic novel, which means rather than the saddle stitch, which are the two staples in the spine, it might have had sort of a magazine flat.
Oh, right, right, right.
Glue binding.
Perfect binding? Is that
might
perfect?
Be, yeah, yeah, perfect binding.
Okay.
And one thing I noticed in looking for something to bring in, that some of my comics, even from the 90s, are starting to yellow.
Oh, yeah.
And that's in a pretty protected space. They're not in bags or anything like that, but they're smashed together in a bookcase.
Right, right.
And so it all comes down to the acid that's already in the paper.
Yeah.
Came from the production. So, you know, I might have to start looking at archival papers and insist on archival papers in my comics, which is unfortunate because most of us can't afford to publish our comics, or most people go to whoever, and for a while it was in Canada. You'd have to send your comic. Anyway, Charles Burns has written Black Hole. It's sort of a science fiction coming-of-age story where these teenagers contract some kind of a strange virus, which is either a metaphor, I think, for STDs or just
the weirdness of being a teenager.
Where instead of developing a rash, they turn into mutants, which who of us doesn't feel like a mutant when we're in our teens anyway?
I feel like a mutant every morning when I roll out of bed. So.
Right. And it's wonderfully drawn and inked, if very dark. It's a he's got a very
boy, you're not kidding. When you say dark, you're not just talking about the subject matter. There's a lot of black ink on those pages.
Yeah, and he does it. I believe he does it with a paintbrush, with a very fine paintbrush.
Yep.
I don't know how he could possibly do this very quickly. I mean, I'm sure over the years he's gotten his system down and been able to do it more quickly. But these are really intricate, where every hair is in place.
Very draftsman-like. Quality drawings.
And he's got, you know, first-rate perspectives and pretty decent accurate depictions of what people look like and scenery and things like that.
Speaking of depictions, I had a page through it. I haven't read it, but I paged through it a little bit before we started recording, and I think it's only fair to point out that this is not your teenager's comic book.
No.
This is pretty...
there are some adult themes.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, that's one right there.
Yeah.
But nothing... Well, she has a tail.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, you get the idea.
Yeah.
But for those of us who have permission or legal right to read whatever we want, it's a pretty interesting read. And for my part, what I look for in a comic book or a film or really anything is that somebody is doing something new with it, something fresh, and also something that, you know, has a gripping story. And I believe that that Charles Burns has always had that kind of work. It's something that pulls me in. It's pretty understated. I've seen him at a convention before.
Uh-huh.
He's kind of a quiet guy, but you know, I got an autograph because I was, you know, I was thrilled. I think he's one of the best professional cartoonists. And let's just be right out front. He is from Philadelphia.
Oh, okay. All right. In that case, let's recommend this book. It's Black Hole by Charles Burns. Looks like it's $17.95 list price in the United States. And that's our guilty pleasure of the week. Art/Geek is produced by Russ Olson and Chris Bailey. Our opening music was Them Say Piano by the 3AM Association. Our closing theme is Since I've Been Loving You by Scomber. To leave a comment, read the show notes, or get more episodes, visit our website, www.art/geek.com. Thanks for listening.
Since you come to my attention, oh baby, now I know what smiles are for. Should I listen to my heart? Or do I listen to my head? Or do I take a step forward? Take a chance like you said. While the Santa Ana blows, my love for you, it grows. Baby, spend some time. Put your loving hand in mine. Since I've been loving.